Welcome, everyone. I'm Paul Niefer. I'm more commonly known as the Farm CPA. I write the Farm CPA column for Top Producer magazine. And the goal of this podcast is to have a conversation with what we would call the top producer farmers across the United States. And joining me today is Rorik Pohlman from, would you say, Northwest Nebraska? How would you view yourself as far as in the Nebraska part, Rorik?
Well, thanks, Paul, and thanks for taking the time today. Actually, Southwest.
Southwest.
Almost equally between Denver and Lincoln, right on I-80. So we're right in the heart of the Ogallala Aquifer, so that's where we call home. So Lincoln County.
And I should have remembered that. I mean, I've been to your place, so I should have known that was Southwest. But, you know, but I got to admit, I came into the office this morning about 2 a.m. I've already done a whole bunch of tax work. So, you know, I probably maybe have somewhat of an excuse for getting that wrong. But why don't we start off, Rorik, with just how is your farm operation structured? What's the history of your farm? Just give us a few minute conversation about your farm operation.
You bet. So 1985, my dad called me, and I was actually working in a commercial world, a six-state business and 300 employees. And my dad called and said, you want a farm? And you know, I didn't even know about what was going on, ag. But I came home, brought my wife and two newborn kids, 2 and 3 years old, and all at once buried my dad 6 months later, 48 years old, and returned the farm over. And in the last, I believe in December of 2012, I own all the original 2,000 acres back. And we built the operation up to a max of about 20,000 acres in the late 90s, early 2000, and decided to start downsizing. None of our four kids were interested at the time. And so approached an employee who had been with me right out of high school, great farmer, and really wanted to get him lunch, and his folks had a little bit of ground. So worked with him on some custom farming and kind of started building it back up again. And he got into a nasty divorce, and I had to turn around and buy that back out again. And during that time, our youngest of four, Zach, he goes, Dad, I'd like to farm. And he was at UNL at the time. And I'm going, oh my gosh, you know, I downsized to about 6,500 acres. And since he's returned, this will be his ninth crop, my 37th. And we're in the process of a significant change in our operation. And that deadline's coming up here the end of March. So, and we can talk about that in a minute. But yeah, we grow a lot of different crops. We're 80% irrigated, 20% rain-fed. So, but all the way from potatoes, popcorn's our big crop. But we've grown everything. Sunflowers, canola, hard red, soft white. I mean, we've grown all kinds of crops, potatoes, sugar beets. Yep. So we've addressed it in a pretty significant way.
Well, and that's the nice thing about having irrigation is that it does allow you, I think, to grow more crops. You know, out in my area where I grew up, we grow wheat, barley once in a while, dry peas, green peas, chickpeas, and lentils. So that's sort of our main crops. But then if you go maybe 40 miles northwest of me, you know, they can grow 60 different crops just because of the irrigation and so on. So that is the nice thing about having irrigation. And again, you are in that nice aquifer that gives you a very good source of water, I would think.
Oh, yeah, it's some of the best in the world, but it's probably some of the most concerning right now is kind of all eyes are on us from the NGOs, you know, environmental community, all the way up to the regulatory. And so it is an ongoing conversation, to say the least, about the water itself, and not only in quantity, you know, how much we have, but also in the quality now. That's those are really serious ongoing conversations.
Now, in the one thing I do know about Nebraska that I would say is maybe a detriment to farmers is that your property tax situation, I don't know if it's the same in Western Nebraska as it is in Eastern Nebraska, because I have several clients over there. I look at their, you know, taxes per acre compared to what I pay on my farm ground that I have or that my cousins have. And I'm like, whoa, you know, you got to have a really good yields in order to cover that. So on your good irrigated ground, what type of property tax per acre payment do you have to pay each year?
Well, and it's interesting enough, it's obviously by classification of soil, but it's also by, you know, the comparables from sales. So, you know, your tax rate and all of those things are varied across the whole area. So the valuations are on a 3-year rolling. And so if you've got some comparables next to you, even though you may have this valuation at this time, and but you get some really high sales because of an investor or a couple of neighbors getting into a, you know, competition for a piece of ground. But typically on average irrigated ground, your taxes are $70 an acre and up from there. It's a lot.
I've seen over $100 on some ground, and I'm like, man, that's when corn is $3 per bushel or $3.10, you know, that's 30 some bushels just, or 35 bushels just to pay for the taxes. So and you mentioned your dad. Was he the first generation, or was there a generation or generations before your dad?
He was the second generation, so I'm the third. So okay. Zach, our son, is the fourth. And I got to tell you this, my 5-year-old grandson, he's the fifth. And and he's funny. He has the farm simulator app on an old cell phone. And the other day he goes, Grandpa, he says, you know, you farm a lot and I know where your stuff is, but I got 20,000 acres and I'm harvesting my canola right now. And I go, Brant, you're five. He goes, so how do you get it harvested? He says, I have 6 combines. And he says, I'm selling my canola right now so I can buy 2 more. So, you know, it's fun, you know, and it speaks to technology, but it also that connection all the way through this whole legacy. It's a big deal.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I definitely left the farm to become a CPA, but, I bought farm ground last year. I bought farm ground both in Iowa and by my house. And I'm still in the mode to probably buy some more farm ground. You just can't get that dirt out of your blood, I think, when you're a farm kid. So, and you sort of mentioned or hinted at it that you are having some major changes in your farm operation coming up here. Why don't you give us some color on that?
Well, you know, in growth and downsizing, and believe me, the downsizing was the biggest challenge we had. And then, you know, figuring out how to get that next generation set up so that A, their debt is manageable, but their working capital is bulletproof. And I started down this path 3 years ago trying to figure out, and I think I've talked to you and Chris Barron and many others, and just trying to figure out a plan and leaning into our peer networks that, just, you know, how do you make this fly? There wasn't a good way without really making it a mess is the way it turned out. And so I looked at selling off pieces. I looked at transfer gifting, nearly every tool that I think I've ever heard you talk about, Paul, quite frankly. And a lot of it just didn't make good sense because, you know, you're trying to hold on to what you built. You know, you have that sweat equity, and also, you know, what's the business side of this that really should be the deciding factor. And we had a lot of 4-person family meetings, my wife and I, and Zach and his wife, and we just spent a lot of time at it, and it came down to a decision that none of us really liked, and that is, you know, sitting on your back porch and you're going to sell what that sweat equity, but you did it. So we did it in a package. And so this package was in such a way that it wasn't carved up and you weren't fighting battles with people to extract your market values. that was the our biggest fear. We tried to sell a piece of property 3 years ago at auction. And, you know, the market wasn't great, but it would have made sense for us for getting some working capital and restructuring a little bit of debt. And, you know, nobody bid. And so all at once that becomes this overtone. And it, quite frankly, really scared us about what our equity was and what it could be. So we really zeroed in on that, Paul.
Okay. And so it sounds like you are selling some of the land, but you're going to then lease it back, or what is happening with that land?
So we sold it with no reservation, and for a couple of reasons. Is it made the most sense to structure for Zach, and we just have, because this is my 37th crop year, I just have a lot of assets that he doesn't need to build his own operation. We have storage buildings, we have shops, I have 750,000 bushels of storage that he doesn't need to move his operation forward, just because of the logistics of today. And his big focus is popcorn. Now, he has some really amazing contracts, so he doesn't need that. So why be burdened with that kind of storage? And it's in excellent shape. So the buyer actually was interested in the whole package. Mm. And we actually, funny thing is, we retained a life estate. We're going to live right in the middle of it. And Zach is going to live rent-free for 4 years. So you think about a young couple, they're now expecting their second, rent is three, and they're expecting their second child any day. So a young producer that is struggling, A, with, markets and health insurance. His wife is a dental hygienist, but good gosh, you know, it's still, and they don't provide insurance where they are, but she's paid well, but finding those revenue sources so that he can structure his business appropriately. We spent the last year and really since really zeroed in on it in December is structuring even, it's funny that you would ever structure a net operating loss so that you could look at transfer of wealth or working around some of these opportunities to mitigate and move capital around. And we're going to have a couple of building projects for him that, so you don't have to think about, 1031s or how you do all of it. So leaning into a significant network of stakeholders, and that included yourself, in terms of just ideas and structure.
Yep.
It has been quite a journey, quite frankly.
Yeah. Well, and my wife and I will have discussions, and we always tell each other, remember, it's not the destination, it's the journey. You know, you want to enjoy that journey. We know there's going to be some ups and downs, but you got to step back and be able to enjoy that journey. So I guess you've really gone, you've had the growth mode. I mean, you've gone up. Now you've decided for various good reasons to go into not a growth mode, but more of a, setting up your son so that he can be successful. And I think that's what all parents want, to make sure that their kids are successful. But if you look back on your 37-year career, as far as on the growth side, what do you think you did right?
Well, my wife said I had 12 lives. She says that often, but I built the operation around having trusted advisors, Paul, and you've always been included in that, and many others, and looking at the opportunities and leveraging every asset, every dollar, and basically not ever taking anything out. Everything was returned back into this operation. But I always said, and what grounded me was, this is a business. And ultimately the decision that we just made 3.5 weeks ago, that this is a business, and businesses at maturity, there's choices you can make. But in terms of structure, you think from 85 at the absolute, bottom of agriculture, I call that, to even where we are today and the cycles that we have literally farmed through, the diversity that we use, the cropping rotations, the willingness to enter into direct producer contracts. And I always said many times, if I didn't have to grow corn and soybeans or even wheat, I wouldn't grow a pound of it. I really enjoyed more of the relationship stuff that was product driven, that we put our stamp on. When our trucks rolled out of here, I own a Valley dealership, and our product or our popcorn or corn rolls out of here, it has Palman Farm stamp on it, and we were pretty proud of that. And I did the packaging thing. We did our own products. I've done a little bit of all of that with varying success. But I have to tell you that it really is and has and will continue to be the network and the people. That is really what drove my success, or our, not even mine. I think when I spoke at the top producer deal, it was about the people around me. I couldn't stand at that podium or even today, even begin to think that if I am solely responsible for where we landed. It's about the people, period.
Yep. I think, and it's the same in our business here. You know, yes, we produce a tax return, but without the people that's behind the scenes or in front of the scenes or however you want to say it, they're the most important asset that we have. It's not the building. It's not even the tax return that we give you. It's the fact that we have good quality people that are producing that product. So I think, Rorick, right now we're going to take a quick little break for a little sponsor message, and then we'll come back and finish up the podcast.
Get timely updates about taxation, accounting, succession planning, and other issues that are unique to farmers and agribusiness processors. Find out about major agribusiness events and how to comply with new laws that affect your business. Subscribe to Farm CPA at blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness and experience the CLA promise. blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness.
Welcome back to the Farm CPA podcast. I'm your host, Paul Niefer. In today's podcast, we are joined by Rorick Palman of Palman Farms. Rorick and his family farms in Nebraska. And what is unique about his story is his decision and his family's decision to downsize the farm operation instead of expanding it. Let's pick up with our conversation. Rorick, I think the one thing I'd like to, right at the end of the first session, we were talking about what you did right in your farming career. Now let's maybe explore maybe what you think you maybe did wrong during your farming career, or the things that you would like to maybe have, if you look back on it and said, man, I wish I'd done something differently for this decision or for this type of crop or whatever it might be.
Well, Paul, it's a really simple answer for me. You know, when you get to in your 60s, you can be reflective, and it's really simple for me. Is the banker that helped me start was amazing, and John, I was actually a pallbearer for his funeral, and from that day on, it was just different about how I grew and the partnership of people. And. And I had brought on a young accountant, same age as I am. In fact, he just retired, but he never really kept up. He just did good enough to kind of take care of us. And if there's one thing that I just absolutely harp on Zach about is understanding your financials, but not just simply understanding that, really driving down to your EBITDA, understanding and not, you know, pushing depreciation to the side, but making sure that your working capital is absolutely bulletproof. And at the end of the day, and making those decisions based off of sound and reliable data, but having and search out that trusted advisor that can really help with that. And I neglected that for probably about a 10-year period. And you kind of just wander around in that time frame. I was farming in South Africa. I was farming in Belize. I was in partnership deals in South America, and it was distracting. And I wasn't paying attention, literally, because I think it had more to do that I needed something to kind of reignite my fire, so to speak. Yeah. And I lost my way. I really did. And And if I tell anybody any different, that's a cornerstone to really what put the biggest challenge in and actually made this decision that we just had the toughest.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you've mentioned working capital a couple of times, you know, about bulletproofing it. The one thing that I will mention many times in seminars that I do for farmers on, you know, finances and so on, is I view working capital like an oil in an engine. If you got enough of it and it's operating smoothly, that engine is going to work very, very well. But once you run out of working capital, that farming engine basically freezes up and it stops. So I definitely understand, you know, what you're talking about on that side. So now I know that you have a spouse that has a fairly nice job. How has that affected, or how has it helped your farming operation to have a spouse that makes some money and probably also provides a little incentive for you to do a good job?
You know, the family part is a blessing. My four children, and I probably should have said this even in the prior comment, but having four kids grow up, three sons and a daughter, and, you know, we grew the operation around them. And so that actually made it easier. And as they started to graduate and go on their own, that presented some challenges. But my wife is a longtime educator and always in the classroom. So in Nebraska, that is one thing teachers are well cared for on the retirement side and also on the benefit side. And you know, on the pay side, not so much. But she ended up with an administrative endorsement. And now, you know, but she's, you know, she has got 40 plus years in a career. And I mean, that's what a lot of us takes to do that. So that has been an absolute blessing. And it's going to be for Zach. His wife is a dental hygienist. She has a nice salary. And gosh, it just makes things and the decisions, especially about your personal expectations out of your operation, much more realistic.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of this being your 37th year of crops, and then Zach's, I think you said, was 9 year. As you move forward, you've sort of, I think, have been in the role of being, let's say, the farm CEO. Have you transitioned that fully to Zach? Or, you know, let's dive into how is the management of the farm between you and Zach? How is that all going right now?
So we've been a part of Granular since they started, and now the insights in agronomy, and that is one thing that Zach has totally embraced, and you know, he's in that age. If it's not on his phone, it's not necessarily useful, and we have fiber to the farm, and now we're working on broadband across our whole farm, and that connectivity, and I have a high level of comfort. He has taken over more and more. He's actually farmed 2,000 or 3,000 acres for the last 3 or 4 years, and you know, good and bad. Actually, last year was a real education for him. That holy smokes, you get whacked in the wrong ways. You know, it's tough to make those ends meet. So that part has been really good. It's been just an amazing transformation from the first crop to the ninth. I retired on January 1st, and for you know multiple reasons and. And my wife kept asking me, Paul, she goes, what are you going to do? I'm going to work for 2 or 3 more years, she said. And I said, hon, after 41 years, you're now asking me what I'm doing? So anyway, we laugh about that. You know what? At some point, and he's ready. And that's probably the biggest thing is I'm going to help him on the marketing and still on the relationship side somewhat. But I stepped away and I've been approached by the company that actually bought the farm from us to run their Nebraska operations, to oversee the growth and expansion of a rather large farm that's vertically integrated all the way from ranches all the way up through the finished product, that pound of protein that's delivered to a grocery store. Oh. So I am really excited about that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
My son's just going, Dad, this is what you've been living, working, and dreaming for the last 10 or 15 years. And again, I'm going to go back to what my wife said about the 12 lives. She goes, I don't know how this happens that you can sell the farm and turn around and work and finish up your career loving what you do. But I have to tell you this, Paul, it's been 40 years since I've filled out an I-9 and a W-3.
And you're like, how do I do this? What do I do?
You know, so, exactly. Yeah. You think about that.
Well, I've lost my Social Security card like 35 years ago. And there was one time when I was filling out an application and they asked me for a Social Security card. And I go, I don't have one. And they almost weren't going to let me, you know, join the operation. I was able to show my tax return and so on and so forth. But, you know, it's just one of those things. So, well, that's exciting. I mean, it's you and I are similar ages. I might be a few years younger, but I think we're pretty similar on age. I just turned 61 a couple months ago, and you know, I'm sort of looking forward to what's next for me. You know, my wife definitely knows that. You know, when I hang up the career of being a CPA, let's say at the firm I'm at now, which will probably happen in here a year or two. Certainly, I'm not going to stop working. You know, I enjoy what I do way too much to stop working. So, but
well, and I hope to be able to contribute to. So I work closely with the University of Nebraska, doing a lot of mentoring. Nebraska College of Technical Agriculture is in Curtis, 90 miles away. I host. It's a 2-year deal I started working with Larry Gosson when he took over as the president there. And I'm on advisory to the USDA. And I'm doing a lot. I do a lot with the legislature. Of course, I ran for state office and got for state legislature and got beat by 125 votes. And again, it's probably the best thing that ever happened to me, but in light of the politics of today. But I haven't stepped away from any of those things. I'm working on a lot with this carbon piece and this whole soil biodiversity. And that's, I believe that figuring out how young men and women can, in agriculture, they're going to have to make their voice heard more than ever. And I think that's going to be an incredible challenge as our legislatures and our state governments and our federal government increasingly are removed from agriculture.
Yeah.
Nebraska's 49 senators, it used to be over 70% of them were within a generation or two of being off the farm. Today, we're down to only 10 or 12 out of the 49 that even have a connection. And that's going to be an uphill challenge for all of us.
But it's also, I think, an opportunity, because if we do a good job, I think it creates, some emotional attachment with that urban population that I think we've sort of ignored. And like you say, we got to get out there, because once you bring, you know, my wife and I, we live on a little ranch. I'm going to call it a ranch. And we got some goats and some chickens. And anytime we bring somebody from the city out there, you can just see that joy on their face of seeing goats for the first time and petting them and just being interactive with them. And it's the same with my granddaughter, who happens to live in Phoenix. But when she comes up to the ranch, she just loves being in that rural situation. Now, maybe they not want to live there, but they certainly understand they definitely understand where their food comes from then.
Well, Paul, the thing that... that us 60-year-olds, and I'm including you and I in that, that not only have we lived through some really interesting cycles in agriculture, but just evolution and change used to happen in what I call even a decade or a 10-year segments, and then it got down to 5 and 3. We talk about 3 for a while, and today it's like 12 months, 18 months, and.
Yeah.
And, you know, what next disruption is there going to be? And so the data and the connectivity and all of those things, how do you even begin to decide what's right for yourself and for your operation? And I think it's going to be really exciting, really exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. And the key is, and you've sort of mentioned already, you got to be nimble. I mean, you got to be willing to make that change. Because if you don't make that necessary change, you're going to be left behind. So I think the good operations understand and embrace the fact that change is going to be more rapid than it's ever been in the past and will continue to get even more rapid. So,
well, the climate change piece, soil health, we've heard it all. Trey talked about the other day. I heard this one. Trey Hill made a statement about Renaissance agriculture. And I, next time I see him, I'm going to give him a hard time because what does that mean? Renaissance agriculture. But you think about that. So I did, I chuckled about it. And then I thought about it. Now, wait a minute, you know, you just mentioned about your granddaughter and my grandkids. We host people from all over the world here looking at innovation and these partnerships that I have with multiple land grant universities and industry. And you're right, hosting here, but doing those things. So what is that? What does that say? And I'm not a soil health guy, or I don't get sustainable. It's just the way we do things. It's the right thing to do in agriculture, and pigeonholing any one of us into a particular aspect or lack of aspect in their operations. That part is the accounting of that is really going to be intriguing and interesting, because that is an amazing story to tell.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned climate change. I think what some people fail to understand is there are certain people that are looking forward to climate change. You know, I think the perception out there is everybody is against climate change. But, you know, if you're a farmer in, let's say, Alberta or Saskatchewan, you're sort of looking forward to climate change because that means you're going to be able to grow more crops, more profitable crops that you've never been able to grow before. Whereas maybe the person down in, let's say, southern Kansas or southern Oklahoma, they're not as interested in climate change. So, you know, that's sort of the dynamics. But that'll be a discussion for another podcast. So,
oh my gosh, one thing leads to another, Paul. And it's great that you're doing these.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to say, Rorik, thank you for taking some time out of your day to do the podcast. What I would like to leave you with is just one question, and that's for you. What does success in farming really mean to you?
You know, raising our family, and at the end of the day, when you're done or you're retiring or whatever, that the wealth, the structure, the idea of the business side of this, that when you walk away for whatever reason, or if you stay engaged, that our family still can have Christmas and Thanksgiving meals, and that they're, for whatever reason, that it doesn't change or drive a wedge in between us as a result of these activities for the last 37 years. And that was a cornerstone. That was an absolute cornerstone to our decision. Is it didn't matter about the rest, because if they don't get along the rest of their lives, then we have failed miserably.
Yeah. That's definitely a good definition of success. So I appreciate that. So, well, again, Rorik, thank you for having this session with us. And I hope maybe we'll do a follow-up session maybe in another year or two to see exactly how things are turning out with the transition with you and your son.
Looking forward to it. We're excited about it. And it's working.
Okay, good. Thanks a lot, Rorik.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. I'm Paul Niefer, and we'll be back next week with a new episode of the Farm CPA podcast with Top Producer.